Welcome to Foresight Friday Roundup, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Burdup, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Friday, December 10th. Santa comes in 2 weeks. So it's time to clean up your act, unless you want to get a lump of coal, courtesy of Joe Manchin. On today's episode of the Roundup, we're going to talk about physician compensation. In some ways, it's a nice follow-up to last week's conversation about the lack of diversity, equity, and inclusion in healthcare. Specifically, we're going to talk about a new study in health affairs on the compensation differences between male and female doctors, and a new study also in health affairs on the compensation differences between employed and independent doctors. To tell us what it says about the industry and what it all means for patients, are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you guys doing this morning? Dave?
My heart is full this morning. Growing up in Minnesota, I cared more about baseball than just about anything else, and my team was the Minnesota Twins. This week, we found out that two of my favorite twins of all time, Tony Oliva and Jim Cott, are going into the Hall of Fame. I used to imitate Tonio's swing in my backyard. And since he used to throw the bat quite a bit, I used to do that too, which wasn't necessarily a good thing. But good for him and good for Kitty Cott. I'm sure I've still got both of their baseball cards back in the attic somewhere.
That's great. Good for you. Julie, how are you doing this morning?
Doing well. I was actually going to raise a little sports as well, but in a very different context. We've been watching the Washington Huskies women's volleyball team, and they just went to nationals and they just lost to Texas. And we're really sad around this house, but they have been so fun to watch.
Great. Good sports topic too. Thank you. Now, before we talk about physician compensation, I wanted to ask you both about your primary care doctors. Dave, is your PCP a man or a woman? Are they employed or independent? And does any of that matter to you?
My PCP is male and works for One Medical. That makes him both employed and independent. One thing I really like about the One Medical model is that they don't own any ancillary services, so they have no financial incentive to amp up medical testing or referrals. I once had a prolonged debate with my PCP at Northwestern about whether or not my company could require me to get lab tests at Quest, which they did. Getting the tests done at Quest cost me nothing. Getting them done at Northwestern would have cost $700. But even with that payment differential, my PCP didn't make it easy for me to get authorization from his office for the tests. So I had to actually make two trips to get simple lab tests. What a waste of time and energy. None of that nonsense happens at One Medical.
Yeah, I think they call that upselling, right? Thanks, Dave. Julie, how about you? Is your regular doctor male or female? Who do they work for? And do you care either way?
You know, I'm also a medical member. And as I was thinking about this, I'm really one of those people who now has a brand as the PCP. One Medical is my PCP. And I've had three different doctors along the way at One Medical. And I don't really care, male, female, doesn't matter. Because what I'm really relying on is that they have the information about me and they know what my history is and they know how to treat me and that they're clinically trained in a very similar way to do so. It's my approach.
Got it. Team approach, patient-centered. That's great. My primary care doctor is a woman. She might be old enough to be my daughter. She's terrific. I think she's employed by her hospital-affiliated practice, and I hope they pay her well and certainly as well as her male counterparts because she's worth every penny. But according to this first study that we're going to talk about, that may not be the case. Researchers from RAND, the University of Chicago, and Harvard used earnings data from more than 80,000 U.S. doctors to calculate the career earnings difference between male and female physicians. Over a simulated 40-year career, female physicians earned about $2 million less than male physicians, about $6 million compared with about $8 million. That's after adjusting for things like work hours, practice type, and medical specialty. Dave, does the earnings gap surprise you? Why do you think there's a gap, and what do we need to do to close it?
You're right, Dave. We're picking up right where we left off last week, looking at inequities in healthcare straight in the eye. So good for you and good for Foresight and good for Julie and good for all of us to bring transparency to these really surprising inequalities. Like last week, the study results did surprise me on several fronts. First, you know, my running group every Saturday likes to start slow and then taper. This is the opposite. Compensation. Yeah, I know. Wait for it. It's coming.
I got it.
Yeah, no, this is the opposite of that. Compensation for women doctors starts high and then the gap increases. It's $42,000 in the first year and grows to $90,000 by year 10. After that, it levels off and women never catch up. Second, and unlike Wagnerian opera, which is better than it sounds, the actual pay gap between male and female doctors is far worse than it appears. And that's because female doctors disproportionately choose to practice in lower paying specialties and in primary care practices. The study properly adjusts for practice variation. If it didn't, the study's lead author estimates the pay gap would be twice as great as it is. So in reality, women doctors, without adjusting for specialty, that gap is more like 100 in year one and 200,000 in year 10. Third, and this is really disturbing, the trend is going the wrong way. The pay gap between male and female physicians actually accelerated between 2014 and 2019. This occurred as the percentage of female physicians in the country has increased steadily and now sits at around 36% of all physicians. You know, you'd think that having a higher percentage of female physicians in the physician workforce would trigger pay equalization, but the exact opposite is occurring. This suggests to me that there's systematic bias against female physicians in all kinds of different ways. You know, I've always loved the Gloria Steinem quote that the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. Based on this study's findings, there should be a lot of pissed off female physicians out there. And regarding that, here's the last point I'll make. In his insightful book, Drive, author Dan Pink created the acronym AMP, A-M-P, for what motivates professional workers. The A is for autonomy, the M is for mastery, and the P is for purpose. So having autonomy, becoming masterful at your craft, and having a sense of purpose, all are strong motivators. Pink made the further observation that compensation really doesn't influence performance, but he had one major caveat. And that caveat was, if people don't think compensation is fair, that's all they can think about. So I've got to believe that these pay gaps, which are large and increasing and skewed by specialty, are enormously frustrating to women physicians and probably contribute to burnout. There are many reasons why America needs to revolutionize its healthcare system. Unfair career barriers and lower compensation for women physicians is yet another black mark against an industry that often serves its own interests at the expense of its own employees as well as the American consumers. We just have to do better, Dave.
Yeah, got it, Dave. Thank you. Julie, is the gender earnings gap just another example of the inequities that exist in healthcare, or does the gap somehow manifest itself in disparities we see in patient care? And is there a way to fix it?
Well, what I didn't want to do is be the woman voice here tripling down on what the study says. So I really did try to step back and poke some holes.
Great.
Well, I'm not so sure it was successful, but as Dave said, you know, this study shows that females earn significantly less when accounting for hours worth, clinical revenue, practice type, specialty, location, experience, all of it. So when I stepped back, I thought about something very experiential, which is walking into the halls of UCSF and seeing these enormous portraits of white men who have run this system over the course of its lifetime, or have been important physician leaders over the course of its lifetime. And let's face it, there is no more patriarchal industry than we sit in right now. So I guess in many ways, this doesn't surprise me, but when I really dug into thinking about and really understanding, you know, what some other studies have shown here, you know, there's a report out last fall that women actually spend more time with their patients and 2.4 minutes on average. So part of the underlying issue of findings in a report like this is the basis that we're looking at pay, which is, again, quantity over quality. And I think Dave and I are broken record on this, but the question is, where are the outcomes, right? And there was another study in JAMA in 2017 of 1.5 million Medicare hospitalizations, which showed that female doctors' patients had much lower mortality and fewer hospitalizations. So that's one snippet years ago, right? But when you look at it through this lens, it's hard to fathom why a healthcare organization would pay women less than men if we're actually demonstrating that women are producing better outcomes. So we're stuck in this hamster wheel of quantity-based everything. And it's, you know, it's frustrating. The one most striking thing I found, and Dave, I don't know if you saw this, but I'd love your opinion on it. A researcher highlighted that the RVUs, which are the relative value units that Medicare uses to determine provider reimbursement. So they looked at RVUs for procedures that are effectively the same. And those RVUs are often higher for male patients than they are for female patients. So you have to ask yourself, well, how did that become the way? And if you believe that there are patterns of women who see female doctors and men who see male doctors, then you might actually see men in leadership roles creating those kinds of policies that turn into higher, you know, rates of pay. So we, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why this could be the case, but I think seeing more females in positions of leadership that can influence some of these structural issues would be fantastic.
Yeah, really interesting connections with outcomes. Thank you, Julie. Dave, anything to add to Julie's comments?
That was a really interesting fact, Julie. I hadn't seen that particular bit of research on women physicians driving better outcomes, probably because they are spending more time up front with patients and more attuned to their specific needs. And I, you know, I'm a broken record on this, but until we really start to pay for outcomes, we can continue to have sort of these crazy and perverse incentives driving care delivery patterns in ways that are ultimately harmful to the American public. And although not specifically on topic, I'm also deeply bothered by the pay gaps between primary and specialty care physicians. The highest paid specialties like plastic surgery and orthopedics are dominated by men and make twice as much as primary care physicians. And since the U.S. healthcare system operates in essence to optimize revenues, this drives care toward higher end specialties, which in turn leads to significant overtreatment in acute care specialties, as well as significant undertreatment in basic and essential primary care and mental health services. Clinical care accounts for only 20% of health outcomes or health status as measured by life expectancy and life quality. Social and economic factors, health behaviors, and the environment account for the other 80%. The system spends way too much on the 20% and way too little on the 80%, which is ultimately counterproductive. And Julie, I'm almost wondering if women physicians fundamentally understand this in an almost organic sense and are working to try to counterbalance that. I think that's where you were going with some of your comments. And the industry overall needs to make that shift from focusing exclusively on healthcare and healthcare payment, ultimately to well-being. And that will require fully engaging female physicians who disproportionately work in primary and preventive care. It also seems beyond obvious that we need to pay PCPs more and specialists less as the overall system focuses on promoting health and not just treating sickness to get to that world that Julie was mentioning, where outcomes and patient engagement really drive the health of the nation, not how much we pay for treating sickness.
Got it. Thanks, Dave. Now let's talk about the second study on physician compensation, which, by the way, was done by most of the same researchers as the first. This time they looked at what happens to doc comp after a hospital or health system buys and owns the practice. They found that overall, compensation went down slightly for all acquired physicians as a whole. It went down slightly for non-surgical specialties and went up slightly for primary care, and it went up slightly for surgical specialties. And doctors did worse compensation-wise if they were bought by a not-for-profit hospital compared with a for-profit hospital. That's kind of interesting. Julie, it sounds like vertical integration isn't benefiting doctors in terms of increasing their income. What are your takeaways from the study? Any lessons to be learned for new care delivery models?
Well, Dave just set this up actually really well, talking about which types of physicians can actually influence our future. So I don't think this is necessarily new in discovery, this information, but findings do suggest that vertical integration is more profitable for hospitals and health systems than the actual physicians being required. And, you know, the stats I saw were things like non-surgical specialists saw a reduction of about 2.5%. Surgical specialists and primary care physicians saw slight income increase, but still in the ranges of surgical specialists were around 2.1% and primary care around 1.2%. So those percentage points are ridiculously small when you think about how estimated hospital revenue goes up by 19% after a practice is required. So clearly, someone's pockets are being lined in a different way in the non-physician ranks, and the physicians might be getting a host. A few notable findings, though, on this is that hospital ownership of physician practices was associated with steeper physician compensation declines when the practice was in a more competitive market or the hospital that was acquiring the practice was a nonprofit organization. So I thought those were kind of two interesting points. And, you know, physicians may not be reaping the financial benefit because these deals are really supporting what I think might be Dave's favorite word, monopsony. Monopsony purchasing of,
all right,
you know, of physician labor. And when employers are concentrated, there's just less competition for these docs and it depresses compensation. So, you know, as we're seeing these markets start to really consolidate, we're going to see more and more of this. And I'll just end on this note. This is not going to be popular for our listeners, I don't think, depending upon where you stand on some of these issues, but it just reminds me of school teachers. We pay people who have the potential to influence our outcomes and our costs the least. And it's demoralizing. So we've got everything sort of backwards here.
Great analogy. Thanks, Julie. Dave, who's winning and who's losing from practice acquisitions by hospitals? What about practice acquisitions by health insurers? That's kind of a newer phenomena. And how does it all affect patients?
Well, I'm going to get to the same place Julie is, but on a slightly different path. Honestly, this study's findings don't bother me anywhere near as much as the first studies. I actually think that small differential between employed and independent physicians reflects an accurate marketplace reality that it's easier to be an employed physician than an independent one. Running your own business is inherently harder, and from that perspective, it makes sense for independent physicians to earn a little bit more money. So that the gap stuff didn't really bother me much at all. The bigger issue, and this is where Julie and I are going to dovetail, is what the system pays physicians to do. In every hospital and health insurance company in this country, there's a secret room. And in that secret room is a gigantic neon sign that flashes optimized revenues. That's where all the important decisions get made. Hospitals use physicians to churn volume. That's why, you know, the income is up a lot more after they acquire physicians. If they're on the hook, insurance companies use physicians to contain volume. In both cases, patients are a secondary consideration. And guess what? If you want to be depressed, this dismal reality is even worse in low-income than high-income states. Despite a lower cost of living, physicians in low-income states like Alabama and Kentucky earn almost 20% more than physicians in high-income states like New York and Massachusetts. The reason for this is that these physicians can manipulate their fee-for-service payment for their own financial benefit. You know, Gloria Steinem was right. The more truth we learn about healthcare, the more pissed off we get.
Thanks, Dave. I've got to get a picture of that neon sign somehow. That would make a great story.
You don't have the clearance, man.
Julie, anything to add to Dave's comments?
Well, the only thing I'll say, and Dave knows this exceedingly well, is not the industry's first rodeo, right? We saw physician practices acquired in the 90s and then spun out after that. We've seen physicians sold the promise of easier, less risky lifestyle and more time with their patients. And then, you know, the acquirer's complaints that those salaried physicians don't work hard enough. So I do think this time is a little bit different for physicians, not necessarily in vertical integration, but I think when we look at horizontal integration, when we look at the roll up of a number of physician groups that are put together for different purposes that we've talked about on this podcast, to look at women's health, to be a national provider under the One Medical brand, for instance, to provide virtual care, you know, all sorts of different models that I think are attracting physicians for reasons why physicians either became physicians or what really appeals to them about the role. So I think one of the big questions is whether verticalization works and in what circumstances.
Interesting. Thanks, Julie. Yeah. If you want to know who benefits from the status quo, just follow the money, right? All right. Thank you, Dave. And thank you, Julie. Now let's briefly talk about other big healthcare news this past week. Julie, what was above the fold for you in terms of big healthcare news?
Well, I saw yesterday a hint that Grand Rounds may be launching an IPO in 2022. And I just have to say, Godspeed. Those public companies are not faring well today.
Yeah, especially after the inflation numbers came out this morning. Thanks, Julie. Dave, what healthcare news made your eyes open a little wider this past week?
Well, literally, the news that made my eyes open wider was that we now have eye drops that can replace reading glasses. That would be a godsend for me. Right now, I've got these things all over the house. But beyond eye drops, I'm getting pumped about our second annual virtual holiday party featuring John Zamm, the piano man, our Foresight Health troubadour. It's on December 15th at 7 p.m. Central Time. Last year's rollicking party featured oldies, holiday songs, and lots of audience requests. This year, we're adding a couple of features, our healthcare parodies. John will sing a few of those. And Dave Berta, you will be our MC par excellence. I'm sure it's going to be spectacular. It's going to begin with our December Foresight Health song. It's beginning to look a lot like value. That was the focus of a dispatch I distributed yesterday. So come join us.
Yeah, should be a good time. In terms of news, for me, it was the administration's plans to help improve maternal health and reduce maternal mortality by expanding Medicaid benefits and identifying the best maternity hospitals. I mean, if you can't take better care of moms and babies, what's the point, right? All right. Thanks, Dave. And thank you, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed on today's show, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can find a recording of this podcast and all our podcasts on the Healthcare Now Radio Network, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other streaming services. Subscribe now and don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.